In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
Welcome to a show made by humans, made for humans, all of us trying to understand artificial intelligence. From SDPB, today is Friday, August 15th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, let's get into how large language models work. You know the ones, the machine supervises itself. It sometimes predicts things in a way that generates stories and recipes and historic events and law cases that never actually existed. These are the generative AI tools that are changing our world. It is a multi-billion dollar industry. The stakes are high. The ethics are, well, that depends. We'll explore AI tools in healthcare and journalism with a focus on large language models this hour. We are broadcasting from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. ChatGPT is one of the most well-known large language models. There are plenty of others. We're going to explore this hour what these models do, how they work, and how they fail. And we'll look at their multi-billion dollar funding and ask when the paywalls are coming. Dr. Andy Behrens is an assistant professor of information systems at Dakota State University's College of Business and Information Systems. He's our guide as we wade into the technicalities of large language models.
So large language models have kind of boomed, I guess, over the last, year and a half. The most prominent one, I guess, that we all kind of hear of and are aware of is ChatGPT. That's kind of the big one. So that's basically a large language model.
What does that mean exactly? A large language model for what?
Yeah. So basically what it does is I guess the best way you can think of it is kind of like a chat bot, right? So what a large language model does is it takes an input essentially from the user. So thinking of talking to, just a conversation, right, between like you and I. So we take inputs and then we process them and then we have an output basically. And so that's a large language model, is that essentially, it's taking inputs from the user. The large language model, like for instance, ChatGPT, scanned basically the whole internet, right? And so you can think of that as its brain, right? And so that's what it's going to kind of reply to your input as, right? So it'll take the input, it'll kind of scan, and then it'll use its internal models to basically, come up with the answer, the output that's most likely, what you're looking for based on that model. So large language model, basically in essence is, you have an input, you type in, something to it. It's going to think, probably not for a long time, but it's going to think, and then it's going to use its model to essentially kind of have an output, and that's basically going to be your conversation, is you'll have your input and then it'll output, and then you go back and forth, and then the large language model kind of keep that context a little bit, and just that's basically the premise of it. So
what's the difference between like a search, like I'm just doing a search for information online, what's the latest news on Israel and Gaza, and it will send me information that the algorithm is feeding, like these are the most popular news articles or whatever, versus, hey, what is the Israeli-Gaza conflict about? And then it's explaining to me, am I on the right track here? Like, help us understand the difference between a basic search, which we're all pretty familiar with, to an AI-generated response based on a large language model.
So the main difference, I guess, that I would sort of say between like a Google search and like a ChatGPT is, in the large language model or ChatGPT, you can sort of, it's pretty easy to adjust your parameters to sort of say in natural language, I guess, what you're looking for, and make some different adjustments. For example, you could like one of the use cases that I would see is like, let's say that I'm teaching a class and I want to figure out maybe what the best practices are for online learners, right? So one of the things, if you want to talk about a difference, right, in Google, like a search to the internet, I would maybe search for best practices for online learners, and that would just be a search I would type in, and maybe it would come up with some relevant resources for sure, and recent ones, right? And so the difference there is that you have kind of a page of resources you can go to navigate to. Versus the LLM or ChatGPT, the large language model, you can type that in there, and it's going to basically allow you to sort of like contextualize that, right? So if I'm again teaching this online class and I want to get some online resources, instead of just showing you the resources, the LLM, you can have that conversation and basically allow it to sort of curate that online experience a little bit better and incorporate some of those principles with the outputs coming back. Right.
Okay.
So it's not, you think of the internet, you maybe just search and you kind of go through some articles, and you search for that. Well, the large language model, it allows you to actually kind of have that conversation and get a little bit more specific into what you're looking for. You maybe have typed something in on Google and you found that it's not really what you were looking for. So then you had to kind of go through, read a couple articles, maybe get that right phrasing. And so the large language model really helps you kind of, speed that up and get that going a little quicker.
Okay, so there are challenges with this, and one of the challenges, you were looking for the gaps in this and trying to tailor your research to addressing some of those gaps. Help us understand what you were looking for and then where you focused your research on.
So, the main thing was, so I've used ChatGPT, or large language models, in practice, again, for some of those examples that I just talked with you about, is just playing around with it. And at DSU, I think that's one of the things that they help us, they kind of encourage us to do, right, is to use some of these new tools and to be at the forefront, of the technology. So really, for me, getting more into the AI space and doing some more of those things has been, helpful in trying to figure out some of these gaps. So one of the things, with large language models is, the example I told you is, or just talked about is, help me make my online course better. Okay. So you could type that in one time to ChatGPT and it would give you one answer. And then maybe you come back, 10 minutes later in a new chat, and it gives you a little bit different of an answer. So the challenge with that has always been kind of my thing, and especially, when you're talking about research and trying to train students, to basically, make sure that their information that they're getting is true and valid and scientific in nature, right? That it's not just made up. That's one of the major challenges of LLMs, is that they do have an opportunity or a chance to hallucinate. So we could say, most of the time it's going to be right, but if you're an expert and you wanted to maybe have it teach you a little bit about something you're interested in, it may not be 100% correct. It may be like 99%, but there may be a little bit of misinformation or something that it generates, because its algorithm is predictive in nature. So it may give you something that isn't exactly quite 100% true, but it's going to give you that output anyways.
So, like if you're doing a law review, it might give you a case that doesn't exist, which we have
It
seen
could, yeah.
in American legal system where somebody argued a case and that case didn't exist, the model hallucinated it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah,
So
and
it's a
so
re so
and
it's a real problem. It's not bunnies on a trampoline with two heads. It's a law case that doesn't exist in front of a judge.
Yep. Yeah. And with, a lot of, there's been, again, a lot of social media posts where people are using it, to do their own, legal work, let's say, or to do, just to kind of speed up a lot of the stuff that they do, which is great. But the one thing you have to do is you have to double check that, right? Because like you said, if you're bringing that before a judge and you're saying, well, this happened in this court case, is like, well, that doesn't exist, right? So that completely destroys credibility there. And that's something that, you know, in my line of work, I want to always try and teach students that too, is it's like, okay, use it, right? I want you to be good at it, but I also want you to know that, like, you have to be careful what, you know, not everything you see on the internet's real, right? We all kind of seen that before, right? So that's kind of one of the things we have to just be mindful of, is that when we're using tools like that, is that we have to also use our brain a little bit.
So help me understand this design theory that you're developing.
Okay, so basically, like you said, with the law case, right? So basically, if we take that kind of example, move it over to the healthcare industry. So my previous research basically looked at kind of clinical decision support systems. So the idea there is that you go to the clinic, you say, "Here are my symptoms," and you know, a lot of times they have clinics. Healthcare organizations, they'll have a clinical decision support system. So that allows, you know, maybe earlier on providers that use it for some training. That's kind of some of the findings we found. They like to use that tool to learn a little bit more. And so what you can do is you can type in, you know, some symptoms into this clinical decision support system, and it's going to basically help you kind of find the diagnosis, right? So the idea was that we were like, okay, you know, large language models exist. They're pretty effective at what they do, for, you know, allowing users to have a conversation, right? And basically say, okay, here's a patient that's coming in. They've got these symptoms. You know, what do you think? Well, back to our previous discussion, we don't necessarily want that language model to lie to us, right? So we don't want it to be like, you know, this person's having a heart attack, when maybe it's definitely not that at all. So we don't want it to fabricate any of those things, any of those diagnoses. So the idea was, is like, okay, let's take a look at, can we design basically a system, a clinical decision support system. So a theory is basically something we can say this will work for one system, one to many systems, right? So we can use this theory if a manager of an IT or IT department at a healthcare organization or a CTO wanted to basically implement a large language model in their clinical decision support. This theory would work across many different organizations. So that's the whole idea. And the idea was, is that we want to try and minimize hallucinations, and kind of make sure, you know, users can trust the system, right? And ensure that, you know, when a provider gets a system, they know that the output is validated and is good to go. So our goal was to try and move forward progress in explainable AI.
Tell me a little bit about the process and bringing students into this research through Dakota State.
Yeah, so you know, pretty straightforward, you know, in terms of the process. So I taught a class called predictive analytics, and basically it's kind of a great class for students to just get kind of used to working with data and trying to essentially, you know, predict an outcome, right? So you can think of it as like forecasting, right? So for forecasting business numbers, and so anyways, so that's kind of where they built, and I was able to meet all these students that we worked with. And you know, they're very interested. They participate in a data analytics competition, and they basically worked on a healthcare data set. And so they were like, you know, this is kind of an interesting problem area. And so that kind of, you know, boosted their interest in the you know, healthcare space. So we all kind of got together, started talking, and they were like, you know, I'm kind of interested in research, I just don't know where to start. And I was like, well, let's just, you know, see what we can kind of come up with. You know, in the students' eyes, large language models, ChatGPT, super prevalent right now, right? It is a very popular tool that they like to use. So you know, that's kind of where we married the interest, was they kind of had an analytics competition. They did very well in it. This team actually got first, so I was very proud of them for that. And that's basically what interest or spurred their interest in kind of getting into both healthcare and then you know, the large language model. So we designed basically, we looked for, like you said earlier, we looked for the gaps in that space, and we were able to basically say, One of the big things that providers are saying is that they want a system that can ultimately, they don't want the hallucinations, right? Obviously, they want to make sure that they can see what sources it came from, PubMed, right? Wherever we want to be able to make sure that we can validate the sources and that it's giving us accurate medical information.
So you have to make sure these students understand where the resources are to find the accurate medical information in the first place. So they have to know, they have to be able to, and to be fair, a freshman or a even a senior in college might not know that. That's something you're learning in the classroom with that guidance. Where do I find good health information? If it's not from my physician, it might be from these sources and not these. So that's one thing that has to happen. Then you have to design the system so that it finds the only the good information and not the others. Where is the hallucination happening though? It's not pulling, it's not just pulling from a bad source. It's making up something that doesn't exist. Do you see what I'm asking there? That's the gap to me. It's like, how is the large language model making up something that never existed on? I could get that it found something bogus, but if it just hallucinated something, that's muddy in my head.
So the large language model, because so that's where kind of we tie in the predictive analytics coursework is basically uses kind of a predictive model to predict essentially what the next word is, right? And so there's a whole lot of
Oh, okay.
Right. So there's a whole lot of kind of madness that happens in the background, but it's basically a predicted number or a threshold, and it's going to meet a certain, so it's going to basically try and predict the next word. So the next word might not always be the right word, but it might not be also tied into a source, right? And that's kind of where the RAG component comes in, retrieval augmented generation, where we tie in basically internet sources, but again, you're using those verifiable web bases, right? Those web
That's
sites.
bananas.
It's pretty wild, once you start getting into it.
Did people know that was going to happen, or was that a surprise? Were
I mean, I
hallucinations, did you predict the hallucinations based on the predictive model?
right, that's the interesting part. And I think that's just, one of the limitations of the model. And now we start to see some of these bigger AI companies are starting to try and, minimize that because they realize, there's just so many of those things where it can start going down the wrong path really quickly. And so they're trying to, kind of put up these guardrails and make sure the systems, are doing the right thing for the,
So if I
the
understand
greater
this
good.
correctly, then a commercial aspect or a commercial application for this would be a system that you could sell to a healthcare organization, or if someone gets hired at a large healthcare organization, they could develop internally, here is how we're going to help our doctors go with their training and the medical degrees that they have, but we also want to give them access to all the data that exists about these diseases to support them and verify the human decisions that they're making in real time. And again, there's a lot of problems with that and how it balances and who learns what, but that's the ideal goal.
Fantastic summary.
Okay.
And that's, in a nutshell, I think, what we would hope to happen is that anybody, as we design this out and you obviously have to get the provider's opinion, how they feel about it and how it looks to them. But large language models are certainly booming right now. So the I mean, it's kind of interesting to think, is this the next step, or is this just a way to really make sure that, if you're going to use something like this, patient safety is the number one thing in mind, right? Where we're not putting any of the patients in jeopardy by, because technology evolves, right? So somebody can, if somebody were to implement this, you want to make sure that, again, that patient safety is top of mind for sure. And that you don't have, maybe a new provider coming in and saying, you know what, this system is the ground truth, right? That's and I know they get their training, beforehand to where they rely on their knowledge too, but we don't want to certainly replace, our thinking with that technology.
Right. More to this conversation after the break. My guest, Professor Andy Behrens, Assistant Professor of Information Systems at Dakota State University in Madison. More about the potential commercialization of AI coming up. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with Professor Andy Behrens. He's with Dakota State University's College of Business and Information Systems. We're discussing the trust in and costs of large language models like ChatGPT. I'm wondering about giving any kind of source attribution in the design or the design theory or the program that you might be designing, in the sense that now, you know, I'm a physician, I have what I think is the diagnosis, but I'd like to make sure that I have access to this great brain of research that this computer is going to help me find. But then I also want to go, like the researchers who put that study in, do they ever get credit for this? Do they get, is there a compensation to the university who developed the, so help me understand how some of that information gets tied back to the original creators of the information.
So if you were kind of an early user of like ChatGPT, it would just spit out basically the text, right? Mm-hmm. So now we're getting into the stage where we again found that these hallucinations were something that was, you know, concerning. So now there's new safeguards in where they've tried to, or they're putting in little tags where you can click on like the tag and it'll take you back to the web page, right, where it was first cited. So it might not be an exhaustive search by any means, but they're at least providing that reference where they can, you know, somebody could go back and find that link, right? And that's part of the RAG system that we're trying to figure out. And so, like you mentioned, right, with the design theory, that's one of the things, you know, we have in there, right, is that, okay, does your system give you the evidence-based sources, right? Mm-hmm. Are they linked, you know, and if that's through PubMed, if that's through a different database? So that's one of the things too, as, you know, students, as they're learning, we want to make sure that they're, again, if you have a source, right, make sure that that source is as accurate and it's saying what you want it to say, right? And I think that's always going to be one of those things where you have to do a little bit of that double checking in certain situations for sure. You know, if it gives you a source and some text with it, and you already know that or have read that in multiple studies, you know, that's probably fine for you to be like, yep, that makes sense. Yeah, I've seen that before. But if you see something brand new in there, you're like, you know, maybe I want to check that source out and go see where that was published, you know, what some of the things they found in that study were. And so we're getting closer to now being able to, I think, minimize, again, some of those hallucinations with now, you know, if we ask for cited sources in these large language models, it'll hopefully spit out the ones that it used. And we're starting to see, even as you use large language models, we're able to see kind of where it's pulling those sources from and how it thinks. And I think that's closer to the explainable AI that that we're trying to work towards in this group.
Yeah. What are the costs of this? Because it's expensive.
Yeah, it is.
Energy production, the man hours, the help us understand the cost, the sustainability of it, the investment that's needed. Yeah. What comes to mind there?
You know, no hard numbers, but it's just the more research that I'm kind of, you know, that the deeper we get into this, we realize that, you know, large language models, you know, and there's already discussions about it that, yeah, it is resource intensive. You know, it's it takes a lot of processing power. And I think that's kind of the next sort of, you know, what's next is, you know, if these are going to, you know, continue to thrive and exist, you know, how do we make sure that those resources are manageable? Because you're absolutely right. There's a ton of research being done now and at organizations, you know, departments that have found that, yeah, this is kind of a heavy lifter to operate, right? It requires some significant resources to operate these large language models. And I think that's kind of one of the interesting issues that we're at now, is we're saying, you know, we see how well it can perform when we give it all these resources and how, you know, pretty crazy the large language models can get, right? So how impressive they can get. But do they need all those resources to sustain, and is that sustainable? And I think that's a really great kind of point that we're at now. And I think a lot of researchers are really kind of digging into that that same aspect too. Is this feasible to move forward, or is it kind of one of those where, the computing resources doesn't match up with the needs of the organization and the costs? And so I think that's something for sure that is a huge consideration right now.
So how do you, and this, I have no idea how this works. When you design a study with students, how are you measuring computing resources?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the first step that we do here, especially with this study, is we take a look at all the literature basically around this ask the study that we're doing, right? So RAG and large language models and clinical decision support. So we take a look at that literature and we see, okay, what are the gaps? And so we find the gap, and this is the gap we chose to go down, which is kind of the explainable AI design theory route. But that aspect that you mentioned, Lori, relates to when we start building it out, right? And so we are in the process of designing, right? That or we've designed the design theory. So now the next step would be for us to actually create it, right? And that's what's going to be what some of the what the students are going to kind of be working on coming up here is the actual design. So we have a bunch of resources and ideas of what we can do to design this out. And then, so to your point, is that's where we would then, assess, okay, is this feasible? Are we getting a solid return on the physician's time, right? Because that's going to be one of the key indicators is like, are they using it, right? And is it helpful to them? And that's one of the things with when we assess technology impact, especially when the users are using it. That's a couple of the key things we kind of look at is, are the utilization of it and does it help them, right? Are they finding value in it? So that would be kind of next step, right? Is to how, assessing that by using kind of variables to figure out, does this help you? Is this changing your workflow a little bit? And then that's kind of after the design, we show it to them and say, what do you think, right? And so that's where we can kind of validate that design theory or find kind of some challenges maybe that we didn't think of as we looked through the literature. And one of the things I come from industry, so you have theory and then you have practice, right? So not always those two align perfectly. So that's why you kind of have to look at both angles.
Yeah. So when you're developing it, you at some point to make the thing, to make the system to sell to the physicians, you have to have something. It's not just assessing their need or their curiosity or their desire to have something better. You have to have a product to give them. And somebody has to invest in building that product so that the hospital system can just buy the product. What I'm trying to get at here is like who makes the investment and how are they measuring how much water is it going to take? How much power electricity from the grid is it going to take? How are we going to that's what I'm wondering at. Like the person who invests in that has to know what are you asking me to give you in that kind of resource investment? It's not just how many FTEs I need and how many years it might take them to do this and where they might do their physical work. It's also these other they're not intangible. It's real water, it's real electricity, it's real.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so the interesting part about kind of the space we're in is in healthcare, the data is protected, right? For good reason, right? So one of the things is why that would be, why that's going to be a major limitation for us in that style of assessment would be that, tying into those systems are not, I mean, that requires a whole thing, right? Because
Yeah, the whole
we have to
thing.
make sure that it's all kosher, right? That we are looking at, at that data. But so to that point, some of the bigger private like electronic health record vendors, those are the people for sure that are already, throwing these implementations in and have, are already kind of testing large language models within their EHRs. I have a couple contacts,
What's EHR? EHR?
electronic health record.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
So
All
like,
right. Got it. Yeah. Sorry.
yeah. So where the patient data goes. So yeah. So they're already kind of testing, these large language models to be able to search through them, type a query into, the EHR and ask a question about a patient, and then it will kind of you'll be able to have a conversation with that in the EHR as the provider. So that's where I think a lot of those companies now are investing those resources to kind of figure out, okay, if an organization implements this, what is the actual impact in terms of, like you said, the water costs, the AC costs, right, to have those machines running in the server rooms, and just the like you said, FTEs also, right? So is there going to be, do we need to have an AI person managing, the model and to make sure there's no hallucinations, right? Or all those things. So yeah, there's a large impact, and you're absolutely right. And those are great questions about, the environment. And I was it's kind of funny you mentioned that, because I was talking to my niece this last weekend, and that was actually the reason one of the main reasons she cited to not using a large language model is that it's just, the environmental impact is pretty significant for a query.
What else did I not ask you that you think people, I mean, it's incredibly complicated. It's interesting, dynamic thinking about the potential in the future for people's real health outcomes, and then also the potential for misuse and, the ethical problems, but then just how these things get made. I think it's the world that we're living in. And we don't often pause to step back and realize exactly all the pieces that are moving it, and how our students who are going to Dakota State are learning how to navigate that work world as well.
Yeah, and I think it's a huge value for, I always try to think of the student first, right? And so I think it's a huge value for them to be a part of just different learning. And I always think back to, my first couple of years in college. I was like, you don't know much about, industry, process, workflow, right? And so I try to kind of rub, give them an idea of like, okay, we're thinking about like when, you're working, you're doing something, there's a process you follow. So just giving them that kind of taste of industry and that there's process involved, and that you can't just kind of throw a system in without really giving it much thought. You have to think about, like you said, environmental impact. Do the users want to use it at all? It's just, yeah, it's pretty awesome. And I know they're enjoying the heck out of it. And yeah, I mean, I just think, final thoughts would be, I don't foresee at this time these large language models are probably going to go away, anytime soon. I think that they'll exist, whether it's a variant of what we have now, or they'll be, specialized uses. So I just think that, it's good to get used to kind of some of those, especially as a newer a student going through college, or just anybody. There's a lot of great ways that these LLMs can provide value. But again, just like with any technology, it's all about harnessing it, right? Just like with anything, how we use it.
That's Andy Behrens with Dakota State University's College of Business and Information Systems. He's an assistant professor of information systems. Up next, we will explore whether an AI model could meet the stringent journalistic standards of modern newsrooms. Spoiler alert, not yet, not even close. Julie Gerstein with the Craig Newmark Center for Journalism Ethics and Security is coming up after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to take a closer look at how artificial intelligence is impacting how we get our news, specifically how experts say AI tools are failing journalism today. Julie Gerstein is a research fellow at the Craig Newmark Center for Journalism Ethics and Security at Columbia University. She's a former executive editor of Business Insider, and she's also co-author of a paper, Can AI Tools Meet Journalistic Standards, published in the Columbia Journalism Review. Take a listen. Like, what are you seeing with AI tools and journalism and the place that they're intersecting?
So I would say that right now every business is trying to understand how to use AI and where to use it. And yeah, a lot of that is coming into the content creation space. Certainly The last newsroom I was in, there was an entire team that was, you know, experimenting with AI and looking at use cases and thinking about where and when it would make sense. And I think since I left that newsroom, that's even increased in that space. And, but I think that there's been enough mistakes. There have been enough, you know, really bad use cases of it that people are approaching it more cautiously than they maybe initially were, which is a good thing.
Yeah, this is big business. These are multi-billion dollar tools, but to your point, if you use them wrong, it can cause lasting reputational harm to a news organization. So give me an example of something that really came back to bite somebody in the news industry.
Yeah, I mean, the maybe the one of the more famous examples was when Sports Illustrated started using AI-generated work and publishing AI-generated work. They did it in a way where they not only used AI-generated writing, but they actually created fake authors. And so they were publishing this writing under AI avatars and with fake names. And so that's sort of the extreme end of an egregious use of AI in journalism. And, you know, certainly that definitely created a lot of problems for Sports Illustrated at the time. They, I guess, they had contracted that content out from another company, and they claimed that they didn't know that that content had been created by AI. But there have been a lot of misuses. And I think it's, you know, these companies are driven by a desire to do more with less. You know, in the current media climate, there's just a lot of competition, there's a lack of resources. And so they're looking for ways to use technology to shortcut.
Right, yeah. So the difference between content and journalism is,
yes,
is what to you?
I guess I would say, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think they're often used super interchangeably. I think that, you know, content is information. Journalism is knowledge. And journalism usually, you know, would involve doing some level of reporting or investigation or research in a way that, you know, is elevating the experience of the reader or is helping the reader learn something or live their life in a better way.
Yeah, seeking truth. And there's,
yes,
also an accountability. So there's ethics. There's a journalistic ethic,
yeah,
behind journalism. And it might look like content, but what makes it, the people who made it are making it with ethical guidelines.
Exactly.
In a newsroom. So let's talk about that with AI. In what ways is AI made with, or, you know, these tools that people are developing, are they made with ethical considerations that are up to journalistic standards? Is that even a desire?
Yeah, I think that that's, I mean, that would be great if they were thinking about that. But I think a lot of the times these companies they're certainly using journalism to feed their large language models. And, you know, that's been something that I think we've seen a lot of companies, a lot of media companies, big and small, have made deals with, you know, OpenAI and Perplexity and others to license their content for these tools. But I don't think they're operating with any sense of ethic around that at all. You know, that's just, for them, it's just an ingestion of content, of words, of, you know, feeding the algorithm, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of becomes decontextualized from maybe the intent that it was written with.
Yeah. Talk about what we're seeing in the industry regarding like plagiarism. Sometimes content is just being lifted, stories are just being lifted, repackaged, presented. There is litigation. There might be genuine plagiarism happening.
Yeah, that's definitely been an issue. And that's why a lot of these, companies are now trying to add citations. They'll often try and add citations. Now, whether those citations are correct, whether those citations are real, it's a whole other story. There's definitely been some cases, ironic, I guess, is a story where Wired was covering a story about AI slop, and then AI reproduced that story. An AI tool made by Perplexity was BS. That was written by someone at Wired, was actually rewritten by Perplexity and fully lifted, the tool fully lifted an entire 25 word sentence. Now, I think that the difficult thing is that this is like a quick moving space, both like in terms of the legal ramifications of it. And so I think that, you know, it's difficult to say whether that would qualify as like infringement of copyright claims. And, you know, I think that that's a space where that's constantly evolving. You know, that I think is something we're probably going to see a lot more of. And I think it's also because of the sheer volume of content that's being produced by these AI engines that it's also a case of like, have they been caught?
Right.
You know,
right. Yeah.
Just can they, you know, have they been caught doing this? Because it's probably happening a lot more than it's being reported.
Yeah. And you also talk in this article in Columbia Journalism Review about the hallucination of the predictive large language model, where a story will be presented that was never written. It's just what the machine or the model has decided would have been the next. Like when you start an email and it finishes a sentence for you, it's finishing an article that no human being ever wrote, and it's completely wrong. It's completely off.
Right. And the danger with that is that the AI will hallucinate, you know, either some kind of like academic writing or some kind of factual piece of information, and create a citation that's not real. There's a funny story that came out recently by Max Reed, who has a Substack called Reed Max, about Alara Voss, which is the name that started popping up around 2022, 2023, and has been used as a citation as an author on like 6 or 7 different scientific studies, and has an IMDb and all of these other kinds of citations in AI generated articles, but is not a real person. The AI just keeps ingesting the name Alara Voss and using it again and again and again. And so this fake person keeps getting more and more citations for different things. So that's a really good example of how, and I think that the thing is that the algorithm can mimic the veneer of scientific writing or scientific study well enough that if you're not clicking on the links, if you're not actually going to the source, if you're not doing your research and actually checking on what it's saying, you wouldn't know.
Yeah. So journalists need to be aware of when they're information gathering, and consumers are perhaps overwhelmed by all the information that might be at them that they don't know where it came from. But even journalists, what I'm hearing you say, you know, if you're looking for a study, you better not be using the Google AI overview.
Correct. I mean, then this is where it also gets to a point where is it actually more work to use an AI tool than it would be to just do the research yourself? Because you're actually having to fact check the AI. Whereas if you just did the research yourself, you wouldn't have to.
Right. At some point, it becomes cheaper. I mean, the argument is always that it's more affordable and more efficient to have the AI tool do the work. But at some point, once you've gone through all the checking, it will circle around to be actually more affordable and efficient to have the human being do it.
Exactly. And I think the thing, too, is that that's, you know, in the best case scenario, what we're finding, obviously, is that with the spread of misinformation, most people are not doing that checking. Right. And so we just have a society where Google recommends that you put glue in your pizza and people go, oh, okay. You know, which is a real thing that happened. You know, Google AI recommended to people put glue as an ingredient into like a pizza recipe. And wow, that was top result when people looked for a pizza recipe for a couple days. So, you know, I think it can be really potentially very dangerous. And that's a funny example, but certainly like the spread of misinformation, there's a lot more really nefarious things that can happen.
And here's another favorite one that I had, which was asking the AI overview to how many rocks you should eat. And it said you should have, you should digest one small pebble a day. And when people investigated that, it was from an Onion article, which is a satirical news organization, as a joke. And somehow it ended up being pulled as a legitimate news source. I'm sure the Onion staff are having a nice laugh about that and trying, you know, to the point, though, that the bot doesn't know. And the people, the bot doesn't know. But so we're all, and then bias. There's also this idea of journalistic bias, which is a political hot button. But in this case, whoever designs the large language model can have great influence on what that model is pulling and what it's telling people about the world.
Right. And that is, the bias can kind of enter at any point, right? So the bias can be part of the way the algorithm is designed by the AI engineers. It can be part of the way the information that it's ingesting too, right? And we know that the internet has so much misinformation. There's a lot of racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic information online. And so it's not, the tool itself is an agnostic tool, but the information it's ingesting is not. And so therefore, like, there's going to inherently be bias created by the content it ingests as well. Yeah. So there's a lot of ways that these tools can emulate the worst parts of ourselves.
Yeah. And the worst parts of the internet. Yeah.
And mostly the worst parts of the internet. Yeah.
Which reflect the worst parts of ourselves. All right. What can newsrooms do to help keep up with this information and large language models, the LLMs? In what ways should newsrooms be aware of what's happening in AI with AI tools and how it might impact their journalism? What are some best practices, do you think?
So I think that, you know, I spoke to a lot of standards editors and journalism professors and ethics experts for this work that I did with Margaret Sullivan on this paper. And I think that the common thread is that it's really about creating like a group of newsroom stakeholders from across the organization that can help make decisions about AI policy in the newsroom. So that might mean editors and reporters, but also maybe someone from the tech side of the organization. A lot of media orgs are now hiring specifically for into AI roles. And then it's about developing policy that makes sense for the organization. I would say the key things that most organizations are adopting in terms of their AI policies, you know, and how they use AI and think about AI are around accountability, responsibility, and disclosure, and then human in the loop. So what we mean by human in the loop is that nothing gets published without being reviewed by an actual person.
That's Julie Gerstein. She co-wrote Can AI Tools Meet Journalistic Standards? You can find that article in the Columbia Journalism Review, co-authored with Margaret Sullivan. Gerstein is also a research fellow at the Craig Newmark Center for Journalism Ethics and Security at Columbia University. She's former executive editor of Business Insider. That's our show for today, none of which was made with the assistance of artificial intelligence. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by the human beings, Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I am your human host, Lori Walsh. We're all South Dakotans. And from all of us here at SDPB, we thank you for listening.